Happy New Year, everyone. This is Chuck Gregory, the new American Dream radio show. If you're traveling in the North Country Fair, where the winds hit heavy on the borderline, remember me to one who lives there. She once was a true love of mine. If you go when the snowflakes storm, when the rivers freeze and the summer ends, please see if she's wearing a coat so warm to keep her from the howling wind. Please see for me if her hair hangs long, if it rolls and flows all down her breast. Come see for me if her hair hangs long, for that's the way I remember her best. I'm a-wondering if she remembers me at all. Many times I've often prayed, in the darkness of my night, in the brightness of my day. So if you're traveling in the North Country Fair, where the winds hit heavy on the borderline, remember me to one who lives there. She once was a true love of mine. Well, can you believe it? It's 2020. Wow, I mean, remember, well, doesn't seem that long ago. We were all worried about Y2K and whether everything was going to blow up or stop working or whatever when it turned into a, you know, the year 2000. Now we're in 2020. Wow. It's just crazy. The first guest of the new year was also one of the first guests on the New American Dream radio show. And I am very happy to welcome Ava Bird to the show. We're calling her up right now. You know, our show started in February 3rd of 2011, and Ava Bird was one of the guests on that show, and here she is again, still with us, faithfully. Happy New Year, Ava.
Hey, Chuck. Happy New Year to you, too. What date did you say that was?
February 3, 2011 was the first show.
Wow, 2011. So that's almost, what is that? Is that 9 years?
Yeah, 9 years. Yeah.
Wow, I can't believe that. Time flies when you're doing the work, you know, doing the holy work.
Yeah, really. Really.
Well, I appreciate you guys having me on all these years and, you know, just inviting me back month after month, year after year. I really appreciate it, and I always plan something nice for you guys, and I always look forward to it, and I always make time in my schedule to be there, even if we have to pre-record. So thanks again. I really appreciate it, and I just wanted to also, again, wish you and everybody in the New American Dream world a happy new year, happy 2020. It looks like a nice number set up. 2020, it's all even numbers. Not that that necessarily means anything, but it just looks nice. And I think it's going to be a great year. It's also, for Chinese astrology, it's the year of the rat, which is, we don't consider the rat a very respectable being in the West, but in the East, in Chinese culture, they really admire the rat for its ingenuity and craftiness and shrewdness and intelligence. So the year of the rat's actually a good year. So I'm wishing that for everybody. And I will get started on my piece that is very fresh. I just wrote it. And here it goes. it's time to get that lead out. Heads up, get that mercury out of the bones, out of the environment, off the planet, out of those tissues and mouths, out of the bowels, bobblehead inside my thoughts, racing head, shaving, back to bed finally. Then the spiders behind the headboard, things biting, hickeys on places where only the spouses see. Really? You did it with someone else? You cheated with an idiot box, watching news shows dressed in clown suits, ties for nooses to choke the smoke out of those bombs around the world. Super potent sized, double extra large, triple X, pornified eyes fixed, addicted on the screen, at blood and pain and terror and tears, tearing the wombs out, cutting the cords of the Mother Earth into a state of terror. Fuck them for money, for downloads, for ads clicked. Just bring the bling and the sting at the end. The cum shot to show her who's boss. But it's her that reigns supreme in the end. It's the Earth that will survive long after we are bombed or frozen or microwaved off of here. We didn't do it right. We had chemicals, DDT, Agent Orange, and atomic bombs, missiles and factory farms. We poisoned our own food system and didn't even care. They drank the Kool-Aid water with fluoride and arsenic. All those drugs again. The drilling and the killing. He switches the story and makes himself God, giving us an invisible cause up in the sky, flying on sleighs and eating, sneaking at home and asking for money, eating and eating and always needing another write-off, another property. So much real estate, yet always paying off another class action for child sex abuse. Me too. Dare we call it rape, or is it just indecency with a minor? Should we scale it back and call it porn, or just say he wanted it? He asked for it. He knew what he was doing. At 12, he was seducing me, staring at me as I asked for his sins, as he sang with the choir boys he flirted, those muscle tees and tight pants, and his single mother. He needed it. He needed a man's guidance and support. With no father, he asked for it. He needed it. It's good for him. It'll make him strong and savvy. Just think of all the experience he'll have so young. We're doing him a favor. And then there's this treatment of the earth again. The authoritarian, brutalitarian, religious war machine. This berserk, insane machine that just keeps eating and grazing and raising and eating and raising and puking and jerking off. Eating and eating the corpses of the other. Slap them on the grill and knock a few more back while we dance to Eminem. Get that drunk smile going. Keep that death machine raging. Keep those invisible bombs dropping. The cutbacks coming. The spies listening. Google purging. Microsoft in through the back door. Intel inside. The CIA, MKUltra. Drug dusting. Prisons for profits. That racism, that sexism, that lack of environmentalism. That national security military TV state, electronic fake media, the drug wars, LSD, crack, Paxil, the addiction to those broken spirits over robbed opportunities and energy crisis, climate change, global warming, shaking up a snow globe. Plastic's in the blood now. Can't see it, can't hear it, can't smell it, but they haunt you. The phantom fees hidden in your gas taxes, cable bills and airline tickets. The letters from the IRS, the wage slave shackles getting not so invisible anymore. It's sitting right there on the sidewalk, under the freeways in bright colors, the sleeping families. Veterans and teachers setting up tents and degenerate ditches, just trying to survive this brutal capitalistic corporate patriarch porn show. Regime featuring fascist-friendly smiling mixed races. And gender's fluid now, sneaking in women's shelters. Inner minds and bodies, planting more invisible bombs, burying that industrial warfare deep inside the psyche. Here comes MKUltra again, mainstreamed into TV now. Now not such a secret. Drug ads bragging about incontinence and awkward leaks. The war's on you now. Pfizer gets away with it, trafficking and killing and maiming bodies in the name of profit. Are you depressed or anxious? You could have social anxiety disorder from all the MSG and CIA and IBS and ED and OMG. It's another disease creeping up. It's time to pop another one. It's time to go deep and see what's wrong in the land of the not-so-free, the home of the slave, democracy not. Really look into giving it all to Amazon. Read the Post, the Washington Freak Show. Who's your favorite freak? You like the wars. You like the satanic shit. The bombs for peace and humanitarian wars. The gangster mobster scenes. The jolly joker who demands. Pay those taxes. Suck up to the Federal Reserve. Send them a check in fear and stay quiet. Then flip that switch on for some laughs and bubblegum. And now I'm funny. I know I laugh at your games and silly things like pills and wars and gods and shots and vaccines. I mean, fuck you, man, poking pricks in deep with heavy metals, heavy corruption and death chemicals, aluminum, formaldehyde to preserve your autism problems. Now, I mean, what's with the news? You're still cheating, still watching, still listening, still zombie staring, more reporting on nonsense and drug wars again. That what the fuck again? More nonsense, that canned laughter, beef jerky. Are you serious with the wartime? You haven't heard about manners, not touching others without their permission. That includes lands and bodies, neighborhoods, and get off me, man. I want to be left to my gardens and kombucha and get the F out of my front porch and uteruses. Mind your own. Take care of your mother planet. Plant it. Plant a tree in green. Stay out of people's yards and countries. Thanks. Leave me a note that you did it so I can share it. All right, the end.
Wow, Ava, that was just amazing. What a way to start the new year.
Yep, I planned something nice for you guys, and you know, just blam.
You sure? Well, you sure? You made something nice. I mean, wow. I'm blown away. Well, I'm so lucky to have you, still with me on the show, and hey, got some books coming out soon that we'll tell people about probably next time. And
okay, great.
Thank you so much, and a happy new year.
Hey, you're welcome again, Chuck, and again, I appreciate all the years being on the show, and let's toast up to a great 2020. And I hope things get better for everybody, everybody in the world, the planet, Mother Earth, and all of us on it. I do wish the best for everybody.
Absolutely. All right.
Talk to you soon, Chuck.
Okay.
Thanks again.
Thank you. My next guest, since I have... almost enough time, is Frank Cordero. I spoke with Frank earlier. He's at the Des Moines Catholic Worker, and here's what we have to say.
Hello, Chuck.
Hello, Frank. How are you?
Well, I'm climbing up the stairs.
Okay.
I'm doing the meal tonight at 6. A little shift. I prepared a big platter of beef with corn, just cooking it for hours, and it'll be really succulent, gooey, and
right.
And then I'm gonna have rice. Oh, the rice, yes. And then a vegetable salad. So I've come up into my room. I'm trying to shut off the noise. I just have, and I'm now ready to. Talk to you and wish you a happy new year.
Well, yes, happy new year to you.
And that our efforts at the end of the year, our third annual Feast of the Holy Innocents vigil and line crossing at the Iowa Des Moines Drone Command Center went off as planned. We had a total of 9 people at the site.
Huh. Yeah.
The oldest, though, was Reverend Chet Gwynn in his 90s. God bless him.
Wow.
Just
wow.
So grateful that he came. And Eddie Bloomer and myself moseyed on up to the gate and proceeded to go through the ritual. And this time one of the Des Moines police got a little gabby, wanted to talk, I guess.
Really?
Because he just, he just did not want to arrest us. So he says, this is just a waste of time. You're wasting our time, the city's time. Why don't you just go over there where you can stand and do the same thing and not arrest it unless you want to get arrested. Is that what you want to get arrested? I go, no, sir, we do not want to get arrested. But we're aware that it could be a consequence of what we're trying to do. Oh, that makes no sense. And he just, and then he just said, and they just, but it was an opportunity for me to say, because there were about, by the time we got done with this conversation, there were about 10 to 15 guards of all types around just listening.
Right.
And on the other side, and well, I'll take, there are at least 10. The guy said, you know, I said, don't tell me you want to get arrested. I said, sir, when you ask a protester their intent, like what we want to do, I can tell you that I want to see this war crime that's happening right now. People are getting killed by these people who are operating these drones from Des Moines. He said, I don't care about that. You may not care, but you're asking for my intent, sir. So when you ask a protester our intent, we're going to tell you. So I'm doing this rhetorical thing with him loud enough, but explaining, hey, this is an ongoing war crime. We got evidence that at least once a month, more than once a month in the year 2018, they were given the okay to do a kill, and no one's doing anything about it. So that was interesting. But ultimately, we got cuffed. He was a real idiot. But by the time we got into the police car and then transferred to the police van with another guy, and then to the Polk County and into the familiar holding cells, the ritual process, one holding cell with your clothes on, and then you get booked, go through a whole booking process, and they get your clothes, and you get to put on one of their sets of clothes, and then they give you a blanket, and they put you in the holding cell you're going to spend a night in, which is just a cement block with a cement block shelf that one would call a bench, but there's nothing soft about any place. And open, just open.
Yeah.
People rarely poop. They just can't. You know, you just wait till you get in another place.
Yeah,
right. And they, the blanket, you either use it as a pillow or you use it as a mattress or you use it as a blanket, but you can't use it for free. Makes the night a very long night. Eddie and I, old guys that we are, the oldest guys in the one in our cell, and, you know, it ain't easy. That's all I can say. And the other thing, it's sure as hell doable.
Huh.
And by that I mean people like me or anyone my age or younger who can do a night in jail should do it on a regular basis. Hmm. For no other reason but the a spiritual and reality of incarceration become one and the same, but you once have at least some modicum, a shameful modicum identity with the 2 million people being locked up right now. And I'm sitting there, even I'm as uncomfortable as I am. Both Eddie and I know that we're leaving tomorrow. It's a cooked thing. We're going to be strut our ass in front of the judge and say guilty, and they're going to, well, at this time they gave us $1,000 fines. We have top out, baby.
Huh.
But we don't pay them. We don't pay them because we're Catholic workers, and we can afford, get this now, we can afford not to pay them. Because we've created our life where property is not in ownership, and we don't have to have cars. So, it can be done. But the poor can't avoid that. And everyone who came into that cell was in worse shape than Eddie and me. Every one of them, we knew it.
Man.
You had to. It had to be, because we were doing something we were proud of.
Yeah.
So, it's a place more people like us should be. That's all I got to say. Sort of like a kind of a little kind of an ad, like, come to the next demo, Armed Forces Day in May. Do a night in jail, get away. We can make it all done in 24 hours. I mean, who can promise you that kind of complete experience in such a package moment? In any event, I was thinking about the new year and what I wanted to talk to you about, and it's, we just can't get around it. for me, my the New Year is ushered in with a boding sense of a shoe to fall. And that certainly has to do with Jess and Ruby.
Of course.
I have a great deal of investment in both these good women. And this whole process, I talked to one of the attorneys I know, Bill Quigley, about this scene. It's just getting so uncomfortable and difficult. And he just gave me some good advice. He said, look, he says, you're running it like it's a 100-yard dash. You're looking at... You're looking at a 2,000 yard run here, and you got to pace yourself, and then being reminded of how fucking slow the feds move, how all of their ugly devices in which they can use, and they just do them routinely. I mean, this isn't anything, and the nature of these crimes by virtue of how they indicted them makes it very serious. So you're just, it's just very difficult. The beauty of all this is I think both Jess and Ruby are where they need to be and want to be. And they're demonstrating who they are by how they're living right now. And that speaks tons. The other thing, though, for me is just a great, great kind of sadness that when the time came, the city of Des Moines, the people I know and love, and the community I live in were not there for them. Not enough for them to feel that they could be with us now. And that is a great scandal and sadness for me. I have yet to recover and assess.
Yeah.
So that being so, the way we live here, you know, here on the home front, we got a drone command center, a full ongoing up-to-date, 24/7 war crime. We all know what's happening. We all know the United States is doing drone warfare, illegal, immoral, unjust, because nobody can defend it. If we stop long enough and hold them accountable, stop giving them a test, upgrade the goddamn thing and condemn it as it should be. All right, that's my position. But no one, it's a silence. And we're doing this ritual out there, and we're just, it's a lonely, odd, weird, strange thing. I mean, 50 years ago, 40 years ago, I could spill the bag in front of the president and you know, get a lot of attention, or a blood spilling at the Pentagon, or you know, just a number of things that can show that we got people were looking. Eddie Bloomer and I spent the night in jail. No one even knows about it. No one even in the peace movement cares about it. I don't know. I don't know. Yeah.
Well, that was Frank Cordero from the Des Moines Catholic Worker. This is the New American Dream Radio Show, and you're listening on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Talk to you after the station break. Welcome back, everyone. Once again, I am Chuck Gregory. This is the New American Dream Radio Show. Our next guest of the evening is Philip Verugio. Phil joins me each week from Port Orange, Florida. And Phil's been with me for doing a weekly column for a long time, but this past summer we bumped it up to a full half-hour segment. And he always has something interesting. So here we're going to add him into the show right now. And he should be answering.
Okay, Chucky. Chucky.
Hey, Phillip.
I'm here, Chucky. I'm here, Chucky.
Okay.
Modern technology. Technological breakthrough. All right,
Happy
here we go.
Year,
How
Phillip.
Low can you go? How low can you go, Chuck? Here we go. This writer has always been told since childhood that I was a funny guy. I was and is able to bring humor to everyday occurrences. Having attempted at times to do stand-up comedy way back when, the thought of making a career of it always crossed my mind. In 1992, with my college buddy, J.D., securing the Morning Man spot on flagship station WABC Radio in New York, I did some improvisational bits live on air. My character, Dino, was a wise guy boss of a Brooklyn crew who happened to be married to a domineering Jewish wife, and it went over well. So well that many who listened to the interplay between host Jay and myself figured that the creator of the Sopranos HBO series, who happened to be from the metro New York City area, must have gotten his ideas from us. Who will ever know? Anyway, fast forward 20 years from then. Having heard of an amateur comedy contest in St. Augustine, Florida, 1 hour's drive from my home, I decided to take the plunge. I signed up for the contest and was told that each contestant would have 8 minutes on stage. Well, being a writer and always looking for some bits of truth entangled in humor, I wrote my shtick. One such segment would be based upon my own experiences with needing a slew of dental work. In my bit, I explained how, with the fact that so many of us have no dental coverage or very little of it, this is how a visit to a dentist's office in the near future would look. The dentist, while surveying my mouth to his dental assistant, who was taking notes. Okay, let's see, number 10, $350. Number 21, $1,100. Number 19, $1,100 plus another $1,000. So, the night in question soon arrived, and I was nervous, having waited 30 years in between comedy club gigs. I got to the place and surveyed the crowd. There were 37 people sitting at tables around the stage. The master of ceremonies met me and told me that I would be the first to go on, which is not the best of situations. He assured me that he himself, a professional comedian, would warm up the audience before introducing me. So I sat on a bar stool off to the left of the audience, sweating profusely. The MC began doing strictly tit and fart jokes. The audience was in stitches. I knew I was in trouble, and was I. He finished up, introduced me for my 8 minutes, and on I went. Well, one lady sitting up front to my left just laughed at everything I tossed out. The other 36 people, dead silence. My mouth was so dry, I was surprised I could last the 8 minutes. I did, went back to my bar stool, sat for 10 minutes, and got the hell out of there. You know, there's been an epidemic throughout our nation that is more deadly than the flu or opioid addiction. Simply said, it is this lowbrow culture that has inculcated all walks of life. With a carnival barker in the White House, nastiness and insults flung far and wide, America is the laughingstock of the industrialized world. Mo, Larry, and Curly are the linchpins of what was once the most humorous of nations. If Mort Sahl ever attempted to go on stage nowadays, he would most likely be tar and feathered. The cerebral humor of the late George Carlin, while still cherished by those of us who actually study history and appreciate real dissent, is not what the doctor ordered anymore. We are now a totally lowbrow nation, with some exceptions. Poking fun at weaknesses in human beings replaces weaknesses in character of those in power. Howard Stern and the late Don Imus made this pathway to a low-class country their focal points. Locker room humor, something that many of us, this writer included, love to inject in private interplay, is now publicly front and center. President Cheetos, as I call him, is another and terrible example of this tragic loss of high culture. Those who stand with their stupid red MAGA baseball caps and signs, shouting obscenities in response to his own, are the bastard children of this low-class America. As with those fools, thugs, and asses in 1930s Germany, wearing those brown and black uniforms, zig-heiling as they destroyed Jewish citizens, their businesses, and synagogues, so too are we approaching that Rubicon, maybe even as early as 2020. Thank you.
Well, Phil, you know, I sometimes do open mic events, and so I can I could really relate to this story as you're talking about your experience in this comedy club. I actually got well. Hey, I actually got kicked off the stage.
what did you do?
I was saying whatever I was trying to say. Yeah, you know, I opened with a song and then I talked some, and it was too controversial, too political. They don't like that stuff here.
No, they don't.
I couldn't believe it.
Yeah, I mean, if you could have seen my Chuck, it's unbelievable. 37 people. One lady was laughing at everything, and I did it for 8 minutes. I had the whole thing written out, and oh. I was doing, and my mouth got so dry halfway through. I swear, I forgot to bring. Usually they have like a bottle of water they bring on stage with them. I forgot to do that. I was so nervous. My mouth was so dry. I don't know how I was able to keep talking, and it was so humiliating. I mean, 36 people just looked at me. There's nothing. I mean, no laughter, no chuckles. It was amazing. And I wrote my own bit, and you know that one thing I shared with you folks in this piece about the dentist. Because to me, it's true, you know. I mean, all they talk about is how much it's going to cost you for this tooth and that tooth and this tooth, you know. And it's like a joke, because over half the people who go to these guys or women don't have insurance or have horrible insurance, and you got to pay cash, you know. So anyway, it's a lowbrow country, and it's really... I hate to say it, you know, because I don't want to sound, partisan. You know, I'm really not a Democrat. As you know, I have my issues with them. But my issues with them come from the left. I'm to the left of the Democrats. You know, I'm a true socialist. Yeah, so, you know, but it's this thing since he got on the campaign trail in 2015, this lowbrow culture, it's so scary. It really is. I mean, you know, I changed my registration to, you know, Democrat recently because I want to vote in the primary here. I want to vote for Sanders. But basically, I'm going to vote in the next election, as much as I don't like everybody but Sanders. You know, I'm going to vote for the Democrats because, Chuck, it's scary. I mean, this right wing, I call it neo-fascism. These people are really scary, Chuck. They really are.
Yeah, yeah. Of course, there's no guarantee that Mr. Trump will still be in office, by the time of the election. You know, this impeachment thing might get him out, or he might resign.
And then you'll have Pence.
And then we'll have
You'll
Pence.
Have President Pence. The President Pence, who is right wing than Trump.
Is this a frying pan and fire situation?
Yeah, because basically Pence is an evangelical. He's a right wing evangelical Christian. He's not even a conservative. They're even far right conservatives. That's not why Trump picked him. That's why they told Trump to pick him.
Right.
The people that are behind the scenes, the wizards, like the Wizard of Oz, you know, with Judy Garland, you know.
Yeah.
It's the wizards. Yeah, it's the wizards behind the scenes that influence all these politicians, all these presidents.
Oh,
and
of course.
It's scary because, Chuck, really, I mean, if you just, I don't know about you, but I drive around a lot. You know, I see these, you know, bumper stickers. I see people with these red baseball caps, you know, Make America Great Again, and Trump 2020. There's a guy, now they have a new bumper sticker that's going to be out all over. It says Trump 2020, re-elect Trump 2020, great economy, great jobs. I don't know. Where are they talking about great jobs?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you want to go to Walmart, you want to go to the box stores,
Yeah.
You know, where are the great jobs? You know, really. I mean, they're jobs, yeah, but they're not all great jobs, you know.
Really, the good jobs got shipped overseas.
Yeah, right, the good jobs. Did you know,
yeah,
let me ask you a question. Did you know, and this was about 15 years ago, that they even, listen to this, they have offshored radiology readings.
What?
When people get an X-ray, it's read by a radiologist in India because the person is getting paid less, and they send the results back of the reading.
Yeah, that sounds right.
I kid you not. I'm serious.
I'm not surprised.
Yeah. I mean, you call up any of these companies for, like, customer service, you're getting either India, the Philippines, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm not putting down these people, but as you probably, if you have experienced this, a lot of them don't speak the best English, you know, they're not, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really...
But heck, they don't need to understand it. They have their script to follow. You say one thing, they give the response that they're told to give.
Yeah.
Simple.
You know what? You know what I have to do every year with the Sirius radio. You know, the ones that are in your car.
Yeah.
What I have to do every year is that they tell you when you sign up for 1 year with a certain deal, they call it a promotion.
Mm.
It's only good for 1 year. And they tell you that. I mean, they're honest enough to tell you it's only good for 1 year. And they bury, but you know, they only in the fine print do they tell you that after 1 year you will be renewed automatically at the regular rate.
Right.
And the regular rate is usually $100 to $150 a year more than the deal that you signed up for.
Right.
And what you have to do every year.
Yeah,
and this year I was late. And I forgot to call. No, I called like a week or two after it was too late.
Yeah.
And on my credit card, you know, because they renewed it on your credit card.
Right.
It was $144 more than I should have been charged. But it was all legal, see? So what you'd have to do is you have to call up prior to the year being up. And
did
here's what you have
to
say. I'm being serious now. No, this is when you have to save them. I'm not making this up.
Did you get them to reverse it, Phil?
Yes, I did. I did.
Okay.
I did. Okay.
Yeah, I hate those automatic renewal things. You know, another one that I have that's like that is iDrive. It's a backup service for my computer. And
all right.
I got a warning from them that they were going to be, you know, renewing on such and such a date, and it was $89. So I'm going, whoa. Because I think I spent $7 last year. I canceled the auto renewal, and I went back and signed up again as if I were starting over, and I got the $7 rate.
Unbelievable. That's the same thing with me.
It's
Sirius,
crazy.
Sirius,
yeah.
Here's what you have to do with Sirius. Listen to this.
Yeah.
You have to call them up before the year is up.
Hmm.
Now, they claim that they send you a notice. I think if I got it this year, maybe they slipped it in through their next 7 days of viewing that they send you, you know, like a little email.
Yeah, maybe.
And they probably slipped it in there, saying that your renewal is going to be as of like a week from now or 2 weeks from now.
Right.
You have to call up. You have to call up and say to the you got to wait till you get to the customer service number, blah blah blah. And you say, yes, this is my account number, blah blah blah. Yeah, I'm canceling.
Yep.
Why are you canceling? Well, it's too expensive. I can't. I just can't afford the rates. But if you give me the same deal you gave me last year, then I'll renew. Oh. Okay, Mr. Philip. You know, they're from foreign country,
right.
And they call you Mr. Philip.
Mr. Philip.
Okay, Mr. Philip. Yeah, Mr. Philip. Let me see what I can do for you, Mr. Philip. And you're right. Then they have that script in front of them. Yeah. I can give you blah, 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 blah for the next 12 months. And it's like maybe $10, $20 more than it was, you know, the year before, right? But it's not $100, $144 more, you know?
Right.
So you say, okay, I'll take that deal. And then you go over the thing with the credit card, when you're going to use, blah, 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 blah. And that's what you have to do every year.
Yeah.
You have to call them and cancel.
Yep.
Isn't that stupid?
So many things are working that way now. You know, you have to be really careful. Watch that date. You know, cancel the thing before it gets there. It's crazy.
Yeah, but it shouldn't be that way, Chuck. We shouldn't have to live like this.
Well, no, it shouldn't be that way, but it is. It's capitalism.
Yeah. Yeah, I know what it is. I know what it is. Believe me, it's a corporatism.
Right.
You know, it's funny about capitalism.
Yes, exactly. Really.
I'm a socialist.
Capitalism isn't but the corporate takeover of it is pretty much of a mess.
Well, I'll tell you why. Because if you're a true capitalist, if somebody's a true capitalist and they believe in the marketplace and free enterprise and competition.
Right.
If there's real capitalism, you would have real competition, and you would have more than one company that has a service or a product line that's competing with three other or four other companies. And then you might have a level playing field where you can get the best deal. That doesn't happen anymore.
Yep.
It doesn't happen anymore. And it's just sad because it's all part of this low brow culture that we live in.
Yeah.
That, you know, I can't explain it. I don't know. I think it's just that the public in general is just not aware. And it's amazing. You know, it's like when you bring your car in and you want to trade it in, right? So some guy says to me, "Whoa, I just got a new car." "Oh, yeah, yeah. What happened to the other car?" "Oh, I traded it in." "Oh, I got a great deal." I go, really? He goes, "Oh, yeah, more than I expected. More than I expected." I said, "You know why you got the great deal, don't you? Because they jacked up the price of the new car you're getting."
Exactly.
They're charging you. They're taking out whatever deal you got on that trade-in. It's being transferred to an increased cost on the car that you just bought.
Of course.
That's what they do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's just sad. I mean, it really is. It's. But you agree with me about the lowbrow, you know, culture that we live in?
Yeah. It's increasingly difficult to find quality humor. You know, people. I mean, it's all, like you said, tits and farts.
The guy got on stage, the MC, and they were laughing their asses off. Everything was fart and tits and farts. And these lowbrow jokes, you know, and oh, were they laughing? They were hysterical laughing, and I'm just sitting there saying, I'm dead. I am totally. I'm gonna get killed. It's just that there's not a sophistication anymore.
Yeah.
You know what it is, Chuck? I don't think people read anymore.
A lot of them don't. Yeah. Very true.
The librarian told me a friend of mine, a lady who works there.
Yeah.
She said, "Oh, we get more movies taken out than we do books."
I'm
she
sure
said,
they
by
do.
A far yeah. margin. By a far oh, yeah. margin, she
yeah.
said.
Huh.
And people go into the library to use the computers.
Yeah.
So it's packed. Whenever you go into a library where I live, there's hardly any seats. They're all taken by people using their computer.
Yeah.
But do people go in there to walk up and down the aisles to look at to look at books? No.
Yeah.
People don't read, Chuck. Well, and when they do read, they read articles. And otherwise, they'll read.
Yeah, they read magazines that have lots of pictures and very short, headlines, no real commentary.
My stepdaughter, my stepdaughter was raised, you know, I met her mother when she was five.
Uh-huh.
And she was an only child. She was an only child. And I always read. I'm a reader. And I'm not saying it's because of me. It's, I mean, the kid actually had the interest. But the fact of the matter is, this kid always read books as a young girl all the way through. Oh, she was always reading, and she became like the number two graduate student at her high school. And at, you know, the high school's down here. You got thousands of kids go.
Yeah.
She was the number two, and she went to UCF, University of Central Florida, and she was a 4.0. You know, just a bright kid, always read. She still reads, always reading, always reading, always reading. She got a job with the Seattle Children's Hospital. She has a really good job out there, and she worked her way up, you know, because she didn't have the training for that. You know, she majored in English, I think English or, you know, literature or something. But the fact is that it was the reading that helped this kid.
Yeah.
It was the reading. You know, people that read on a regular basis, but we don't have much of that anymore.
Yeah. Well.
As Chauncey Gardner, before you go.
Yeah.
As Chauncey Gardner in the brilliant movie Being There, you know, Peter Sellers, Shirley MacLaine, the movie called Being There. As Chauncey Gardner said, the character that Peter Sellers played, she said, "Do you read?" And he goes, "I like to watch television." He liked to watch television. Yeah. Anyway.
Okay. Peter, Philip, thank you.
Yes.
This was fun, and welcome to 2020, and talk to you next week.
And my wife says that MAGA stands really for Make America Greedy Again.
Well, that seemed about right. That definitely
Take care.
Seems to fit. All right. Thanks again.
Bye-bye.
And to all of our listeners out there, thank you for joining us right here on the New American Dream Radio Show. I'm Chuck Gregory. That was Philip Perugio. And we are streaming live on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Talk to you after the station break. Welcome back, everyone, to the New American Dream Radio Show. Our next guest of the evening is Azora Espino. I spoke with Azora at some length earlier today, and here's that interview right now. Well, on this first week of the new year, I'm pleased to welcome Azora Crispino to our show. Happy New Year, Azora.
Happy New Year. Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, it's always a pleasure. Now, you know, a few months ago, we were talking about the whole failure of the justice system. You know, the police, the courts, the prison, everything is messed up. And you were talking about training as being one of the primary lacks or causes.
Well, just as a quick summary, part of what I was trying to say is that we have a policing situation in this country, but we don't have an emergency response situation in this country. So if, for example, let's say that a mother and a daughter are having a conflict. Now, the mom probably does not want her daughter going to jail. But let's say for the sake of argument that they're yelling and they're screaming at each other and one of them lays hands on the other. In our current system, let's say the mom calls 911 because she wants some sort of resolution because the daughter has just laid hands on her. In this situation, daughter is going to get arrested, go to jail. The next morning, the mom is probably going to realize, oh, my goodness, I just did something really bad to my daughter. I don't want her to be in jail. I just didn't know what to do in that situation. And so most likely she's going to end up bailing her out. Now, let's say that the charges at that point end up getting dropped, right? Mother says, I'm not going to testify against my daughter. daughter now has an arrest record. Okay, so that's kind of our standard status quo situation.
Right.
Now let's think about what would this look like if we had an emergency response situation. We might get somebody like a counselor that was trained in emergency response who would come in and say, okay, is there someplace else that the daughter can go spend the night, right? We think that the two of you need to get away from each other. And then we might have some sort of short-term crisis counseling, right, to discuss what the root causes were of the situation, perhaps with them separately. And then we could imagine a situation where the mother and the daughter would enter into some sort of month and a half mediation scenario, right? So let's say that the proximate cause of the argument was over chores, but the real cause of the argument was over some unacknowledged trauma from years earlier, right? A daughter's probably not going to lay hands on a mom that didn't lay hands on her at some previous point in her life.
Right.
So we might then have an emergency response that was concerned with, one, making sure that there's no harm to either party, right? These two people probably do need to be separated. And then, two, get at a short-term solution, right? Maybe they help them mediate over a chores contract, something like that. And then a long-term solution that says, okay, you both need to go into individual counseling and long-term counseling in order – and excuse me, family counseling in order to address the root cause of the issue. And the point here is that in our current society, police don't have any interest in resolving the problem. They only have interest in managing the problem. So when you say that it's a lack of training, please understand that in my view, it's a conceptualization problem as well as a training problem. Because a police officer is going to look at it as, okay, what law was broken and what can I enforce, right? What force can I bring to this situation? But they're not at all looking at it from the perspective of there has been a wound, there has been a trauma, there has been a conflict, and we need to resolve that conflict. The state doesn't resolve conflicts. The state manages conflict. The idea is if I don't trust my neighbor, I think that I need police and the state in order to handle the situations that might arise between us. But the truth of the matter is that if that situation were resolved, then I might notice that I don't need government. So government's interest is in managing the situation, but not actually resolving it. So you said earlier the criminal justice system doesn't work as it was intended. I mean, I would argue that it works exactly as it was intended. It was intended to bring profit to the people that profit from that system. And from that perspective, it does that job very, very well. But if what we're interested in is creating safety in our community, right, which is, I think, what most people think that the criminal justice system is about, then obviously it's not going to attain that goal. You know, and people always say, well, what about the murderers? What about the rapists? You know, the truth of the matter is I know a lot of people convicted of murder, a few who actually did kill someone, the rest that I think were wrongfully convicted. But what the statistics consistently show is that very few people murder a second time. Usually it's the case that a person who kills someone knew the victim, something went wrong, right? I'm thinking one of my pen pals, for example, was on a really bad acid trip and ended up beating his best friend to death.
Wow.
Right, and is now serving 40 to life.
Oh.
And I wonder, you know, first of all, what's his own trauma over having killed his best friend, right?
Yeah.
But secondly, what is the likelihood that this person is going to reoffend? Well, if they're given a path to sobriety and also are getting hallucinogenics that are not tainted, the likelihood that they would have had the bad acid trip in the first place, much less that they would repeat said bad acid trip. Like, I'm guessing that if you wake up to find your best friend dead, you're probably not doing acid again. So what's the risk of recidivism in that case? I mean, I would argue it's really low, but the way that our criminal justice system looks at it is, well, you were using drugs, that's illegal. You killed someone, that's really bad. We're going to throw the book at you. So this person will eventually get out of prison, probably an old man, at a point where, you know, he can no longer work in the prison industry, can no longer really make the state much money because his health care costs are going to get high enough, And at that point, he's going to be released to try to fend for himself. And if he doesn't have family connections, then he'll probably end up homeless for the rest of his life. And it probably won't be very long.
Yeah.
And when you look at these sorts of cases, you realize that, okay, if our goal is safety, how do we achieve safety? Well, we achieve safety by building community, by building connections, by providing resources, by providing services. And people say, well, we don't have the money for all of that. But the truth of the matter is, it's substantially cheaper to prevent these sorts of situations than it is to incarcerate once those situations occur, right? We know that every dollar that's spent in elementary school saves $4 in mass incarceration. That's a fact that's been well documented since the 70s. So I'm not saying anything new. I think that what's missing is the political will to look at prisoners not as an other that needs to be excluded from our society in order for us to be safe, but to realize that the line between good and evil, as Alexander Solzhenitsyn so wisely said, runs between the hearts of all of us. So when I take seriously the notion that I am capable of all sorts of evil in the right situation, then I also have to take seriously the notion that there are no such things as evil people that if we put over there, I'm somehow going to be safe. That safety means realizing that conflict is perhaps an inherent part of human nature, and that what society ought to be doing is helping us to resolve conflict in a way that transforms the situation and makes the situation better for all involved. And also a recognition that a problem between two people is never just about those two people. Right? Their families
right.
and their friends and society as a whole also has played a role in whatever that conflict is. So I often say that I think that the reason why we have prisons is a crisis of imagination. I think that it's not enough to say that policing is currently done incorrectly or that prisons don't rehabilitate. We have to seriously look at this idea of what could we be doing instead. I think that part of the problem is that we don't necessarily have these sorts of pilot programs. So I don't know about the rest of you, but I sometimes like to play the game, you know, if I won the lottery and I had $200 million in my pocket, what would I do? And for me, a lot of what I would like to do is to set up conflict resolution, crisis management, intervention systems, right? Counselors. Whose job it would be that if you call them, right, because you don't want to call 911 on your daughter or your boyfriend or whoever
right.
it is, that these people would come in and they would be trained in de-escalation and conflict resolution and, you know, have all of those skills to be able to come up with a short-term safety plan and then a longer-term resolution. Because I think that if we were dumping even a fraction of the money that we're currently dumping into policing, into these sorts of alternate resolution methods, then I think that we could see a sharp decrease in the number of people that are locked up. But, you know, in Travis County in Texas, where Austin is, right now there's a big conversation about should we be building a women's jail? And the idea is that women aren't getting educational services and they're not getting proper access to health care. And, oh, if we just had this big, shiny new building, then we could do all of these things for women. And my thought is, why aren't we building affordable housing for women, right? When was the last time
right.
that we built affordable housing that was not an institution of incarceration? Why are we not putting a lot of money into counseling for women and also for men who may be likely to abuse women or already have in order to prevent those cycles of domestic violence from continuing? Why aren't we putting that money into programs for food and shelter and job retraining, right? Psychological support. The truth of the matter is, because that doesn't make the people who win the contract any money, right? I mean, if
yeah.
you have a $500,000 for counselor's contract that goes to some nonprofit, you know, they're going to use 3 to 5% to maybe hire a secretary. There's not a profit of margin or a profit, excuse me, there's not a profit margin in that.
Right.
There absolutely is a huge profit margin in being the person who wins the contract to build the shiny new jail, right? So
no
we
doubt.
Increase the number of people who are arrested for stupid things, whether it's by having money bail or by arresting people for being homeless or, you know, whatever it is. We drive up those numbers, then we say we need the shiny new building, and then someone down the line is going to make a lot of money off that shiny new building. And well, then we say, well, but what else could we do? And part of the problem is there are very few forces that are actively investing time and money and resources into alternative systems. I'm not saying that they don't exist, but they're normally
right.
being done, you know, as small pilot projects from maybe a nonprofit that has gotten, you know, a grant from some private organization, but there's not really, you know, a systemic effort to say, okay, what can we do to prevent these sorts of conflicts from arising to the point that now we say that we quote unquote have no choice
right.
but to put this person in jail. When in certain situations, okay, these two people do need to be separated. But separating them might be as simple as we're going to give you a ride to your friend's house who's on the other side of town, and you're going to absolutely promise us that you're not going to go home for the next 3 days until you've both had a chance to cool off.
Hmm.
Does that person really need to spend the night in jail, or do they just need a safe place to be able to calm down? And if we take seriously the notion that what they need is a safe place, then maybe that safe place could look a lot more like a hotel and a lot less like a jail. But that's not where the political will is. You know, we're not
right.
interested in investigating those kinds of alternatives, and there's nobody putting serious money in it because there's no profit motive in investing serious money into it. So then the question becomes, well, what can I do as an individual? And for those of you who you know, are thinking it's January, I want to donate some more money, I would strongly encourage you to volunteer and donate to Ending My Need Bail initiatives. So Chicago Bail Fund, for example, you can donate whatever money. They'll use it to bail somebody out who's been sitting in jail because they can't make a $500 bail or, you know, maybe $2,000. They'll bail that person out. And then once that person goes to court and is, you know, has their hearing heard and whatever, that money is returned and then it's used to bail out the next person.
Right.
And these are the sorts of things that as individuals we can do. Or even, you know, you have a friend, you have a neighbor that you see is having a conflict. You could dial 911. Or if you know that neighbor well enough, you might say, hey, I hear that you and your daughter are having an argument. Is there some place I can take her?
Hmm.
Is there some place I can take you? You know, is there someone who can help to mediate that situation?
Right.
I mean, and in certain cases, some counties do have, you know, mental health hotlines that you can call that are not necessarily the police that will send, you know, a social worker or somebody to talk to someone. But there are a lot of restrictions regarding what type of work they can do, and very few people know about them.
Hmm.
So we're not heading in those directions at this time, right? So
right.
one, we need the political will. Two, we need the resources. And three, we need to have the imagination of thinking about, okay, here's the situation that I thought calling the police and having this person arrested or taken away was, quote, the only choice. How might this conflict have been resolved in a different way, right? Let me imagine a different conflict resolution. And then what steps can I take in my own life in terms of furthering that? You know, maybe it's just meditating on it, imagining what the world might be like. Maybe it could be, you know, that there's a couple that really shouldn't be living together, but they're both struggling with money and alcohol and drugs and whatever. And, you know, sometimes things get really heated between them. And you just say, look, if it ever gets really bad and you need a safe place to stay for a couple of nights, you can sleep on my couch. I can't have you there all the time. But, you know, if it's a situation where it's really getting heavy between the two of you and you just need a place to chill out, just call me. I'll, you know, help you get a ride, whatever, and that way you can be someplace safe. That might be enough to de-escalate
right.
the situation. And, I mean, I understand that there are dangers involved in this, right? I mean, sometimes when violence happens, people are going to say, well, I wouldn't want to be the conflict resolution person who would go into this situation where people are hitting each other. What if one of them takes out a gun and shoots me? Okay, I get that that's not the kind of work for everyone, right? That's why we often say, well, we need police because they have vests and batons and, you know, firearms
right.
and all of that.
Right.
But at the same time, we know that when somebody is already angry and they're already violent and they're already at each other's throats, threatening them further is only going to add more fuel to the fire.
Uh-huh.
You know, we can't fight fire with fire. We have to fight it with love. We have to fight it with compassion. We have to fight it with understanding.
Well, I like the idea of an emergency, you know, response team, and basically everything you're saying makes a lot of sense. You mentioned a few things we can do as individuals, and we also somehow have to get the you know, the people that are in power to you know, rethink their agenda. Do you have any ideas on how to do that?
You know, as an anarchist, I'm not super into electoral politics, but I will say that I am currently working on endorsing Mike Siegel in my district. He's a U.S. House rep. Mm. And, you know, he was a civil rights attorney, and he's running against Mike McCall, right? Two Mikes running for the same seat. And Mike McCall basically just doubled down on increasing immigrant detention centers, right? So it's pretty clear that Siegel is a better choice than McCall, right? So
right.
then we get into conversations about either, you know, finding officials that you think need to be replaced and then running somebody better against them. For example, Bastrop County, the district attorney of Bastrop County, Brian Gertz, could single-handedly stop Rodney Reed's execution. He could just withdraw the state's requirement that he be given the death penalty, and that would stop the execution immediately. From what I understand, he could also start a new trial. Now, Gertz has never had a challenger, neither a primary challenger as a Republican or a Democratic challenger. The Gertz family has been running Bastrop County, how did one Southerner describe it to me, since God was a boy. As far as Gertz is concerned, this county is his. It belongs to him.
Yeah.
So what would it look like to find a licensed attorney in the state of Texas, and if you are such a person, please get a hold of me, who would be willing to, you know, either locate to Bastrop or already lives in Bastrop, that would be potentially interested in running against Gertz. Right? Because obviously there's a lot of grassroots work that's being done on behalf of Rodney Reed. There's an infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
But there has yet to be a person who's been identified as a local district attorney. And I think that a lot of times well-meaning attorneys say, well, I want to become a public defender. Yes, and that's wonderful, and we need those. But we also need district attorneys who are doing things like actually giving over evidence when they're supposed to, and are reopening
right.
cases where they think that there's been prosecutorial misconduct. And what I don't see from the abolitionist movement is a cadre of abolitionist attorneys that are actively running for district attorney positions. You know, I've talked to several, and I've tried to convince them, and they've all said to me, well, I couldn't live with myself if I were a district attorney. And, like, I can understand that because, you know, I've considered going to law school, and then I realized, wait a minute, I'd become a lawyer. I don't think that's something that I want to be. So
right.
I get it, right? Like, I get the personal anguish over making this choice. And yet, it may be the case that a well-meaning person could do a lot more as a district attorney, either by refusing to prosecute or by actually following all of the rules and procedures that they're supposed to, you know, or offering alternatives to mediation or, you know, offering plea deals that are legitimate, that could help to decrease incarceration. Because, look, at the end of the day, here's what we know. When public officials or people running for public office realize that a certain idea is no longer popular, they change sides. Right? I mean, Al Gore talked about this with An Inconvenient Truth, right? That he was running against this other public official, and somebody told him, you know, if you just change this one point of view that you have, you will get this many votes and you will win the election. And he did, and he did. Right? Huh. So there is a certain amount of, I may not feel like I have influence on the public officials' wills, but by changing the hearts and minds of the people around me, you know, all of a sudden, when in Texas, the popularity of the death penalty has sharply decreased, right? Mm. Used to be that I think it was in the high 70s that Texans were for the death penalty, and now it's 50-50. That opens the door for somebody to say, run as governor on an anti-death penalty platform and see what happens. Whereas 20 years ago, that would have been a non-starter. You could not have gotten the nomination if you were anti-death penalty. Well, how did that happen? Because advocates have been having those tough conversations with people who disagree with us about why the death penalty needs to be abolished or why prisons need to be abolished. So the other thing that each and every one of you can do is have conversations with people who disagree with you. I think that, especially as a radical, there is a desire to be in your own bubble, right? To live in the echo chamber, to go and have these conversations at whatever, the anarchist scene distro. And there you're preaching to the choir in a way that the choir is going to continue to agree with you.
Right. But you're not going to make any progress.
Exactly. So, you know, maybe it's because I live in Texas. Maybe it's because I teach ethics for a living. But I remember talking about the 2016 prison strike with students, several of whom at the time were correctional officers.
Huh.
And there were a lot of people who said to me, you know, you shouldn't be talking to these people. And I'm like, well, they're my students. I don't have a choice. But more to the point, you know, having a conversation with somebody who you know is going to disagree with you on this particular issue, but looking at it as, I'm just going to try this for fun. You know, start with, what do I think this person has in common with me?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And there are universal human needs. We all believe in safety, right? We all want safety, or we all want to be prosperous, or we all want whatever. And then just have a conversation with someone about whatever it is that you think is going to persuade them. Then try it.
Right.
You know, and there was recently a survey done that was basically, these are the talking points that you should consider when talking to someone. We've done surveys, and we have found that these are the things that are most likely to persuade people. You know, so if you're talking to a Republican, talk about the fact that the death penalty is more expensive than life incarceration.
Okay.
You know,
Azura, we're out of time again, but hey, this was really some fascinating ideas, and I think a good way to start off a new year.
Thank you. Happy New Year to everyone.
All right. And to you. Talk to you next time.
Take care. Thank you.
Welcome back, everyone, to the New American Dream Radio Show, where we're entering the final segment, and we're going to add Karen Katowski to the show. Karen is a former lieutenant colonel in the Marines. She was in the Pentagon on 9/11. She's run for office and is quite active in the politics in her home state of Virginia. And we are very lucky to have Karen as part of our show. And I'm about to add her right about now. So here we go. We're dialing that number. You can find a lot of...
Hello?
Well, hello, Karen. It's Chuck Gregory.
Hello?
The new... Hello, Karen. It's Chuck Gregory.
Me?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Can you hear me?
I can hear you, but I'm going to try again. Well, I don't know what happened there, folks, but we're going to try it again. We had a little... peculiarity, but we're going to try it again. So here we go.
Hello,
Karen.
Hello,
can you hear me this time?
Yes, I can. I can hear you now.
Okay, good. Well, Happy New Year. And,
oh sure, yeah. Happy New Year! What a great time of year.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
it's good. Yeah, I guess, and that's I think what I'll kind of talk about, although it may be a little rambling. I don't know, but yeah, I mean, this is the 2020, and something that's been on my mind. In fact, I just finished writing up an article for Lou Rockwell on kind of at wondering if this is going to be our generation's 2020. Roaring 20s, rather, I should say, that if 2020 will be the onset of a decade of wonderfulness, at least as it seemed to the people in the 1920s, certainly their attitude was, it was this wonderful, wonderful times, everything is flowing, it's good stuff. But I don't see that. I don't see that for our current decade of the 20s.
Really?
I think what we're going to see is a lot of solutions to a lot of the problems and issues that we have. I think these solutions are going to be not necessarily found, but kind of pressed upon us, put forth. And it's going to be, I think, a decade, and we'll see. If this is just my prediction. I'm sure it's a lot of shared, it's probably a shared view of many people, but I think, there's going to be a lot of, I'm looking for the right word. I don't want to say anything that's like harmful and painful, but it will be harmful and painful. It'll be harmful to the attitudes that we and I speak mainly of Americans in general, our generation of people here, but the attitudes that we have towards the role of government, attitudes that we have towards the use of debt, attitudes that we have in this country of the definition of money, attitudes that we have in this country connected to the three things I just mentioned, towards wealth and inequality of economy. All of these things are going to be, we're going to find solutions to this stuff, but it's not so much that the things we put forth as solutions are going to be the solutions, but these things are going to fix themselves almost. The famous Ben Stein's father, who worked for Nixon as his economic advisor, has this famous thing he's known for. And he said, "What doesn't go on, what can't go on forever, doesn't. You know, what won't go on, what can't go on forever, it stops."
Hmm.
And that's what I think we're facing in this coming decade. We have a government. Big government, and it's a lot of people can really convincingly argue that the United States of America is already a socialist country, and they make that argument by looking at the amount of economic assets, wealth, property that is already in complete hands of the government, in the control of our government. Mainly the federal government, but also the state governments. We have 50 little nations, and each of them have a pretty good-sized government apparatus, which owns property, which collects resources from its citizens and from its business that reside there. So, we have a very large government, even though we have 330 million people and four or five time zones, We have a very large government. It's involved in almost every aspect of our lives. And I know here at this show we've talked a number of times of how many ways, how many means and examples that we can think of where government, sometimes very often the federal government, is touching our daily lives. Now, I was looking at an article, and of course I've talked before here, and everybody is interested in, you know, the surveillance state, the concept of surveillance capitalism, you know, the race for our data. You know, this is ongoing. This is, you know, we've been living this. In fact, the last decade has been a huge, we've seen major, major strides in how effectively both commercial and government, I say and, I should say slash government, because we are kind of a socialist state. You know, our major, you know, you look at Amazon and Google and Microsoft, and what's a big source? What do they have? They have multi-billion-dollar contracts with the U.S. government to support the CIA and the DOD and other aspects. I mean, these are not, you know, to say that this is separate, to say that these companies, where a good significant portion of their revenue comes directly from the federal government, a lot of it comes from state governments too. I mean, but the federal government alone, that pocket, that huge amount of money that's put in their pockets, to call them independent, commercial, laissez-faire, capitalist entities, that's a reach. You can't really do that. You cannot really do that. So we have this very large beast that is in our business. It regulates us and it monitors us and it collects our data and calls it its own. You know, treats it as if that product is their data. They went and collected it from us. It's not our data. It's their data. And they'll do with it what they will. And, of course, the government has a different agenda than maybe Amazon. Amazon might want to sell us something. The government wants to know what we're thinking to head off problems. I mean, you know, you can't have, you know, the history of the planet is rife with examples where governments lost touch with their citizens, and then those governments topple. You know, it's not much that you have to take over government. You simply have to stop believing in it. And that's the recipe for the fall of kings and empires. So, you know, stop believing it. I mean, the Romans, you know, the sign that the Roman Empire was over, there are many, many signs, of course, but one of the big ones was people stopped carrying, you know, or they didn't carry Roman passports, but they stopped calling themselves Romans and started calling themselves whatever they, you know, whatever they were closest to. Their local identities were ascendant, not the Roman identity. And so that's nothing more than a simple attitude change. Of course our government is interested in our attitudes. And how are they going to find it out? Well, they find out through Amazon, Google, and, you know, Microsoft. I mean, this is how they find them out. And you know, this is a big part of what governments spend our money doing. Now, it would be one thing, I think, if government could say, well, we have a little pot of money and we've saved for many years and we've done well in the stock market, so we're going to take our profits that we made. Right? Government made these profits. We're going to take our profits. It's our money. And we're going to buy surveillance on you people so that we can figure out, on the one hand, how to be a better government, and on the other hand, how to remain in power. Okay? Because, you know, just in case you guys start forgetting who's in charge here. Now, that would be fine if it was their money, but it's not their money. They didn't save for years and invest wisely. They take it out of our pockets every paycheck, every day, every transaction that we, every time we buy or sell something, the government is taking and it's using that money to do something that I don't think we would really consent to if we were asked for our consent. But of course, we're not. We're not asked, and it's a problem. But anyway, so I think this is where we are in this coming, the launch of the new decade, and you know, technology is the savior, of course, and. You know, we have access to information. The fact that we can carry on. I mean, just think even the radio show that you're doing.
Yeah.
You know?
Sure.
Technology allows us to do this. Technology allows us to talk about what other people around the planet, around the country are writing and thinking and doing. We can put all this together and we can make it meaningful in some way for some people. And then think of the millions of people doing that all at the same time. So, I mean, you know, we are not weak in the face of an all-powerful large government. But we do have a very powerful and a very large government, and it's connected to, it's a corporate state, and it's a socialist corporate state. Now, I don't want to go too far down the fascism line, but a corporate socialist state, you know, this is not something that we hold dear in this country. We're told that this is not a good thing, and yet this is what we have. So I'm thinking that our 20s, whether they're roaring or weeping, are going to be a time where we get to deal with this a little more directly, and also that we get to see reality dealing out some hands to our government. And let me shift forward to the other thing that bothers me a great deal. And of course, I don't want it to sound, depressing or anything like that. I mean, you know, we're alive. It's the new year. There's nothing to be depressed about. But, you know, every time Trump tries to, well, who knows what Trump's trying to do, but every time we see Trump say something about, like, I'm going to bring some troops home, you know, like, I'm going to bring some troops home from Syria, I'm going to bring some troops home from Iraq, Afghanistan, I don't know, whatever it is he says, immediately we see operatives in his own government, or maybe it's just coincidence, but we see, you know, all kinds of new fighting, so that it would look like, oh, well, Mr. Trump, you don't want to look like you're running away from a fight, do you? You know, feeding right into his his ego and his personality type. You know, they've got you pegged. So it's very strange. It's very concerning because I think I talked here before. You know, we've got I think the number is 400 or 500 of these deep penetration nuclear tipped warheads in Saudi Arabia and Bahrain and in the UAE, in the places that they're looking to foment the next war, which was also the last war, the war we've been fighting since the 1950s when we displaced the Shah, you know, when we put the Shah back in power and displaced Mossadegh. You know, so this is a long, long time coming. It's very unfortunate, it's hard to understand for an American to understand, because we have absolutely no interest in Iran or Afghanistan for that matter, or Iraq for that matter. I mean, oil, sure, but you can get that through trade. There's no reason, you know, I mean, seriously, the United States is the biggest exporter of petroleum.
Right.
Now, we haven't always been, but we are now, and we've been that way for over a year, I think for the most of the time that Trump's been president, we have been this major exporter of oil. So we don't even have the excuse of, oh, we're trying to secure oil for the world. The hell? We don't let it. Who cares? But this isn't what it's about, of course. It's about other things, some things that we can't even talk about. But there is a real chance that that the people that want war, and why do they want war? Because it is profitable to them, whether financially profitable or profitable in terms of power, identity, that kind of thing. I mean, it means something to some people. Most Americans, we don't want war. Most of people around the whole planet don't want war. We don't want to fight it. We don't want to send our kids to fight it. We don't want to have to pay for it. We don't want to have to deal with the aftermath. It ruins the environment. The biggest polluter on the planet is the U.S. military. We know that. Stop reminding us, right? We know it. We don't like it. Nobody likes it. But, you know, somebody wants it. And they're working it. They're working it. Trump has been almost entirely unable to bring home any troops. I mean, you know, 1,000 over 3 years. That's about all. For every troop he brings home, another's deployed.
Yeah.
You know, the presence of these nuclear tipped deep penetration missiles that are on the in the region, I guess presumably geared at destroying Iran. If there's an opportunity to do it, and when I say opportunity, I mean a false flag operation, because that would be the opportunity. That would be one you can create control, just how we like to do things. So that's a problem. This is a real problem, because this is why, you know, this is why Romans stopped calling themselves Romans. Okay, and it's why a lot of Americans, even 20 years ago, when they went overseas, said they were Canadians. When somebody asked where they were, oh, I'm a Canadian. Well, no, I'm really an American. I can't say that. Not proud of it. It's not safe. It's not prudent. And this is what's happening. And whether whoever the president is, this trend has been ongoing for the past many years and many presidents.
Oh, yeah.
And it's still going that way. So anyway, I think we'll see some interesting things in this year and certainly in this coming decade. And hopefully it'll be so interesting that we'll write wonderful history about it when we get to 2030 and 2040.
Well, I hope so, yes. it is definitely going to be interesting. So,
yeah, it is. And it has been.
Yes, it has.
It has been.
Yeah.
These years leading up to this have been very interesting. And, you know, I haven't talked about, I don't think I've talked recently about Julian Assange, but, of course, he is. Had his mind destroyed chemically by the U.S. and the U.K., and particularly the U.S., because we are calling the shot. And, you know, I don't need special private information, even though I have special private information. I don't need it to tell you who's pulling the shots, because all you have to do is watch the few times that we've had the trials and watch the British judge. And, you know, the last time that there was an open court, I think an article was written by, I can't remember the guy's name, but he's a well-known, not a dissident, he's actually a former State Department person, an intel guy. He was present in the courtroom, and he talked about the five CIA, CIA lawyers. They were introduced or described as CIA lawyers, that's all we know. But these guys and gals, I don't know what the mix was, periodically dealt, you know, not interrupted, but dealt with the judge throughout the proceedings, even though they weren't that long, giving her guidance, giving the British magistrate guidance as to what they wanted. What kind of world is that?
Convenient.
I mean, I wouldn't even want to call myself a Brit.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. It's very convenient, but it's also humiliating.
Yes.
It's humiliating if you're a citizen of Great Britain, and it's humiliating if you're an average American. This is not how things should go, and that's just one bad example.
Yeah.
You know, this whole devastating treatment of Assange and destruction. And, you know, they're going after WikiLeaks. WikiLeaks is still there, but they have made numerous arrests throughout Europe and the world because they got everything they needed from Assange. They have interrogated him and others. And now they're just broadening the net and pulling in more people. We're not hearing, well, certainly no American, you know, news agency is reporting it. But that story is an ugly, ugly story of what governments do and what they can do and what they do. And they do it with our money, and they do it with our silent consent.
Because
they don't ask us. Because if they ask people, people would say no. But they don't ask us. They just do it. And it's cruel and embarrassing, and it's not anything to be proud of. And this is what... This is our reality, and I think some of that reality is going to start breaking down. I don't think it is sustainable, and I think this coming decade, whether it's due to shocks that are out from outside of the system or internal shocks from the flawed system, I think we're going to see some change and some things breaking loose. And I think also, you know, you can read in the normal media interesting stories about how the wealthy are building bunkers for the not the end times, of course, because they're certainly not, you know, not oriented that way, but building bunkers for the end times of their methodology of prosperity, the end times of their currently being, you know, they want to say, what happens when something really bad happens, and what am I going to do? Well, I'm going to take my family, myself. I mean, they have TV shows. This is common knowledge. It's part of our culture that the very wealthy have very wealthy and very well-appointed emergency survival shelters to survive anything from global warming, a nuclear war, or collapse of major governments of which they have been a part, you know, and they are now, you know, pursued as perhaps you know, war criminals of some type. But this is their outlet, and we read about this and accept that it's real. And I'll tell you, this is a this is part of what I draw on to see, you know, if you want to know what's, you know, what the government thinks is happening in the future, what they think is coming, look at how they're preparing for it. Mm. Well, they're surveilling all the common people and tracking our movements and integrating them with massive databases and using AI and integrating that with law enforcement and military. So that's fine. They're doing that. And then the very wealthy who control the government everywhere, not just here, not just in the U.S. Mm. You know, this is not just a U.S. thing, like we're sinners,
yeah,
and that's why we have rich people controlling our government.
Yeah, right.
It's the whole world, yeah. Okay? Mm. You know, but what are they doing? Well, in addition to whatever they do day to day that we don't get to see, they're building emergency bunkers where they can live and escape to when things get bad. Well, why would they be doing that? For fun. I mean, why not buy a really nice, fun yacht,
yeah, right,
instead of a bunker in a mountain somewhere? Well, because they think it's a possibility. Mm. They're planning for it. They're not stupid. We'd do the same if we had that. If we knew what they knew and had the money they had, we'd do exactly what they're doing. So, you know, these are clues. These are clues that that change is going to be coming, and it will hurt because, I mean, come on. You know, financial collapses, if you spend too much and you can't pay it and you start shorting, you know, either through inflation or contraction of your government redistribution, and 50 to 60% of your population is immediately impacted because they can't buy food anymore. I mean, we've seen this happen all over the place.
Yeah.
All kinds of countries have to write down their currency. Look at Nicaragua, or I'm not saying Nicaragua, but Venezuela is the one that's in the news now. But when you remember how the Soviet Union collapsed, I say collapsed, but, you know, the empire, they split off,
yeah,
all the various countries, and what remained, they had to reissue the ruble several times before they got it right. And the poor and the people who were on, of course, that was a socialist construct country, or communist, it wasn't really communist, but let's say communist, people, almost everybody got their paycheck from the government. And when that money became worthless and didn't buy, you know, it took you only into the third day of the month instead of the 30th.
Yeah.
And people were hungry and starving, and alcoholics couldn't get their booze, okay? You got a big problem. And we actually watched that in our own lifetime. So so Americans should not be surprised that financial mismanagement, war, and corruption at the top, you know, top-heavy governments that do bad things and lose touch with their people, you know, and print money and borrow money that they shouldn't be borrowing, and spend money they shouldn't be spending. I mean, we cannot be surprised that possibly some bad things might come back, even on, you know, our great country and our great population. Of course they will. Absolutely they will. We are not... We may be an exceptional country, but we're not that exceptional. You know, we can't violate the rules of economics. We aren't, you know, living on a different planet than everybody else in the world. We live on the same planet, and we're governed by the same mathematical rules and psychological rules. It's all the same. So what we see happening other places, sure it can happen here. And I think we're going to get some glimpses of it in coming years. I think we spent the last 10 years kind of getting ready for it. And certainly Trump's election, as, you know, curious and interesting as that has been, and of course his presidency, which is also incredibly interesting. I mean, you know, nobody knows who's running the country.
Yeah, right.
And yet we have the most powerful executive on the planet, huh, and we don't know who's running the country. So these are the kinds of things that we've already been through. We've already walked through this. So, yeah, this coming decade, very, very fun and exciting.
Well.
So that's my Happy New Year. That's my Happy New Year message. Get ready. Put your seatbelt on.
Wow. What, well, it is indeed going to be interesting. Pretty scary, but I don't know.
Yes.
It could be fun, too, like you say. I don't know.
That's right. Yeah.
We'll hope.
Yeah, I think so.
Karen, thank you so much for joining me on this first show of 2020. And I'm so lucky to have you on each month. And I look forward to talking to you in February.
Okay, absolutely. We'll talk to you in February.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
And listeners, That's it. We have gotten ourselves to another new American Dream Radio show. Some fascinating guests. I enjoyed the show very much. I enjoyed being here with you. And I hope you had a good time as well. Thank you for joining me. Hope you'll be back next week and every week right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Thank you, everyone, and good night.